All right, I want to introduce our first guest today. His name is Larry Powell. He's the author, creator, and adapter of this play that we're going to be talking about. It's called The Gaze, No Homo, and he's adapted it into a media series, a 12-part series, which you can gain access to by going to the Fountain Theater's Fountain Stream digital platform. And it's presenting Larry's play right now. It's a 12-part series called The Gaze, No Homo, and it's tackling systemic racism and homophobia head-on. So really, check this out. And I'm sure you're going to find it very, very interesting and compelling in terms of making you think a whole lot about what the hell is going on in this world. All right. So check that out. All right. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show my first guest this week. And he's I think he's a remarkable playwright. And he had me laughing. He had me saying, what the hell? And then finding out that I was laughing at things that I shouldn't have been laughing at. But then just really taken in by his work. And it's just an incredible piece. And it's called, am I right here now? It's called No Homo.
Yes, it's the first play in a cycle of plays called The Gaze. And so it's called The Gaze, No Homo.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's jump, and I do have to say, it's really something. I started reading it last night and Lucy had sent it to me earlier. And I thought, okay, well, I'll just, sit in it for a while at the night, like I usually do. And I have a way to actually figure out what's going on. But I really, really, really enjoyed the play. It was remarkable. And I thought the whole way that it was set up, but I also thought just the way you carried out, the what was going on. So let's start by telling people what the play is.
Well, the play is a piece of me, a piece of my community. It's sort of a version of all the stories that I have been feeling and hearing and a part of in the Black theater community all across America. It's a play about a young actor who is out and who identifies as queer, same gender loving. And he is a newbie at this historically very prestigious white theater festival, a new play theater festival. And he's sort of navigating the microaggressions and the systemic issues at that festival. And so I've had a lot of experience in that. And so this play is this sort of a dark satiric look and examination of Black queer work being developed in these historically white American theater spaces.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that got me too, though, is it's a 12-part series, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting because you're reading this and you're listening to it, you're reading it, and you're thinking, wow, where is this coming from? And it's very interesting because the whole way it's laid out, you're almost, even though it's like a very different way, I think, for a lot of people when they think they're going to see a play, to see what you have, and you have the people speaking, as individuals, and they're at the same time, they're all there at the same time in the same level of, I don't know what you'd call it, but it's just people are there in the place with you. And so you're listening to them, you're watching their reactions. And it's much more than just saying, it was a play that was, I just did this to have people talking back and then doing this. But it's actually, first off, I think the title of it, I think this is what you have as a title, right? That you adapted this play, then it's The Gaze, No Homo, and you adapted it into a media series. And it's a 12-part series. Let's tell people about that, why you did that to start off, okay?
Yeah, well, The Gaze, it's The Gaze, G-A-Z-E. And of course, that's a sort of play on words because I am also talking about being a gay actor and a Black actor in a theater scene. But we're also talking about the white gaze and operating under the white male cis hetero gaze of the people who are calling the shots usually or on the boards or even in the audiences or directing the plays. And it was just really, really important for me to be able to speak up this summer, this year. I was also on the front lines as I've always been, but this year I was really, really took it up a notch being on the front lines for the fights for social justice and equity and equality. When George Floyd happened and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and so many others who we don't even know the names of, all of my trans sisters as well, I knew that I had a piece of artivism, art that was also functioning as activism, which I think all great art actually just is inherently. And there was a moment where I saw a quote from Toni Morrison, do believe, and Tony was saying, you know, this is the time artists go to work. You know, this is the time where artists go to work. When the theaters shut down, this is when the time where the playwright said, well, how do I get my story told? So I just really found a way to get my story told. I knew that people had devices. I knew that we had cameras at home. We have iPhones. We have whatever, Androids. We have laptops and all types of things. And there could be a way for us to figure out how to tell the story. But for me, because I'm Larry Powell, it has to be in a dope kind of way.
There you go.
It can't just be people coming on and reading my play on Zoom, because for me, I was already doing that, and there was something about that was just not, that wasn't just, it wasn't hitting the mark for me. It just wasn't cool enough for me, and so I knew that people were sitting at home, and I know that people like to watch things in doses, and so I just took my play scene by scene, and I adapted it into this medium, and so I call it a digiplay too, because you can't watch it all at once as well. You know, people call that binging, or I actually have a digiplay format with an act one and an act two with an intermission, 1 minute intermission in the middle. So you can sit and watch it. It comes out to about 2.5 hours.
Yeah, you know, I watched the whole thing once, and then I watched it in sections right before we did this interview. And I was, you know, because I was thinking about it, it's like there's a lot that's there that you don't really see concentrated in such a way. Just be in society in general, and in the theater world as well, in any arts world, you don't see a lot of things that you actually pressed there, that I thought were very important, and you know the whole idea that you know your character, it's like, you know, this person who you're watching him, and he's at this, you know, at this sort of this coming together of people who are trying to figure out how to, you know, present this certain thing that's going on, and. They're practicing. I guess it's a you know, practice for a play that's coming up, and he's actually trying to figure out, okay, what is it, and he keeps coming up against and opposing a lot of the people. Not, you know, not in a way that he's like saying, oh, shut up or something, but he's actually doing his thing in a way that is causing some trouble in the group overall. But he's wrestling with, well, what the hell are these guys talking about? What are they saying? What are they actually, you know, what is it? How come I'm not seeing what they see? And how come they're not seeing what I see? And there's something that has to actually be played out there. And I thought you did a very good job imposing that all the way through.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, you really get it. You really got it. I'm really happy to talk with you. I'm going to pause for a second. It's really hard for me to hear you. I'm using my psychic skills to really hear you.
But okay.
Literally, it sounds like you're in the Matrix. So I'm being a bit of Neo here, you know, using my my skills. But I will respond while I guess you're addressing that. Yeah, it is important to me that I was able to not only talk about the problem from the other side, not only talk about, you know, the character of Miranda Cryer in my piece, you know, yes, there is always that Miranda Cryer. And a lot of times Miranda Cryers aren't even white women. You know, the Miranda Cryers in my life sometimes have been other brothers, or black, you know, it's just this notion of supremacy. Of I'm the one that knows more than you, that I think can get in the way of education, gets in the way of even in the activism streets, you know, in certain grassroots organizations, you know, it's our egos and our you know, what Martin Luther King talks about, the drum major instinct, like, you know, I have to be the one, I have to be the one that goes first, and I have to be the one that knows. And so I think that Jerome is not perfect either in that. Jerome also, it was important for me that I also implicated Jerome. Like, you know what I mean? It was important for me that I also was like, well, what is Jerome doing wrong? Jerome is the protagonist in my piece. And though he is struggling and feeling misunderstood and very much so is being misunderstood, but there are some times where he is misunderstanding the others in the room and in the space. And so I tried to find a way to make it so that, you know, if you look closely, you'll see that no one is right and no one is wrong in this space at all times. You know, everyone is trying to figure it out. And I think that if I'm successful here, that I'm understanding or that the audience is like grappling with, well, do we need to continue in this way? What do we need to fix? If I'm successful, the audience is left with like a sort of burning desire to examine the moments of where they have felt those ways, like Jerome is feeling or other characters are feeling in the piece.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that struck me too is that, you know, again, you're dealing with a very serious topic and you're doing it in a way that actually is funny a lot of times. But then even as you're listening, and it's revealing at the same time, but you're listening to this. And even when it's funny, you're sort of sitting back and saying, wait a minute, this is okay. It's funny, but it's not funny, you know, and there's a lot of things that are actually said in that that I thought were very, very important. And you said that in order to properly experience your own exodus of the decentralization of the white gaze in your creative work and reclaim your black imagination, this play, developing this play, actually had a lot to do with your ability to do that. I thought that was an important insight, you know, that you were laying bare for people.
That is what I continue to be wowed by, you know? Like, that's what I'm talking about with Jerome's journey, specifically. Jerome has been centering the white gaze. And I was centering the white gaze in my life, in my work. You know, I went to a school called Oakwood School, which I'm thankful for. I'm not throwing it all away as I discover this in myself. It's not like I'm throwing it all away either. I have to be clear about that. But it's just that it's like, wow, like I really like there were just a time in my life where I was like, white is right. Even me being from a family that is so, you know, I come from Black Panthers. I come from all types of things, like, you know, Black preachers, it's even that, like the strength of being in the belly of the beast, in a way, and sort of, and be, at such a young age, you know, not knowing the difference between the owning of my own imagination and where I come from and doing it for them. You know, it's a really kind of confusing space to be at. And I just knew that I couldn't continue to work. I couldn't continue to breathe and live as an artist until I really addressed it.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very important. We're running up out of on our time, but I have a couple of things I wanted to ask you. You know, you know, you talked about your own exodus of the decentralization of the white gaze in your creative work, and you're talking about that now in terms of the reclaiming of black imagination. And I thought it was really interesting that No Homo is the first of your gaze plays, which is what I read. And I thought that was really interesting in that it examines the process of building a culturally specific and queer work of color in certain historically white spaces. And they do it in a way that's not, you know, that's not, it's in a very interesting way because it actually, in the play itself, it confronts people with all the things that they think they're so cool on, but they're not, you know, and people trying to figure out what's going on. And even, you know, even, and I won't give away anything in it, but there's, you know, there's a thing that happens where someone who is there and is part of the whole scene and has really, you know, been working with all these people for a while, and you present something, your character presents something to him that just blows his mind. And I thought that was really an important thing in terms of seeing how, you know, people are wrestling with hard topics and, you know, but at the same time, when they begin to see that the hard topics can be true and need to be dealt with, that opens up a whole new world for some people. And I thought that was a really important part of your play in the way that it comes, that it rolls on and towards the end.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you really got it there. I mean, you know, one of my favorite mentors taught me a long time ago, we satirize things that we love. And I love the theater community. Like, it's all I've known, really. It's been my life, you know? And so I have to keep laughing because I see the absurdity in us, but it comes from a space of deep love. Like, you know, and how do we rebuild? How do we go forward? How do we take all this poison and turn it into medicine, right? How do we transform, you know, these things that aren't working into things that can serve us and really have us reach our dreams of speaking to the audiences of today and the audiences of tomorrow? Because, you know, theater is a sacred tradition. It is necessary in the illumination of the human spirit, right? But it doesn't but it shifts and it changes. That's why I call this a digiplay. Like, you know, it plays, the play is the thing, right? But it went from screenplay to teleplay to digiplay. So let's be a digiplay and see what happens from here. But let's not ignore it. And that, let's not feel like we're failing because we can't be in our theaters. No, the story is larger than the buildings.
Mm-hmm. Now, we got to wrap this up real soon, but I just have one last question for you, which I think is really, really important. And it's a question. Basically, you pose this, and I think it's really important for people to understand this. You pose, why strain to be free under a gaze fixed on your imprisonment when you're the one holding the key?
Yeah, you know, there is this, I really believe, this sort of comfortability or this addiction to capitalism. I think there's this need to just be comfortable in the way things have gone because it feels like too much work to make something work. It's too much work to make it better and to come together and to resist that whole gatekeeper notion and to actually help each other out and to actually talk to each other as if you're human and actually be in a space where you don't have to prove yourself. If you feel like you got to prove yourself, you need to walk out of that room because you ain't got to do that. And I think that that's the question. Why are you doing that? Why am I staying there? Larry, why am I staying in these rooms? Why am I accepting these jobs when I know this is how they run at this theater or in this place? You know, I know that's how they roll. Why am I taking it? Because I have to eat. Yes, yes. But then, okay, beyond that, because there are food banks. There are other ways to eat. Is this truly the only option to continue to feel as though you have no agency and no respect in your creativity? And I think for me, the answer is no. There is always another way. You go where you feel honored and celebrated, and you work from there because the work is better, and we need the good work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean it.
All right, Larry Powell, thank you very much for your work, and thanks for being on the show today, man.
Thanks, Michael.
All right, talk to you again soon, I hope.
Okay, yeah, of course.
Take care, man. Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Larry Powell. Larry is the author of the 12-part play called The Gays No Homo, and it's tackling systemic racism, homophobia, and other elements head-on.